Broke and Patriotic. A Bates College sociologist looks at why poor Americans love their country so much. A question that seemed paradoxical to Professor Francesco Duino was this: how come those who have the least in our country seem to be even more patriotic than those with the most? Without judgment, Duino set out to find the answer by interviewing more than 60 people in two states, Alabama and Montana. He talked with people of all ages and backgrounds who had one thing in common. They didn't have very much money. They were poor. Duino found common ground among them, and he discusses it in his new book, Broke and Patriotic: Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Duino about his research, his findings, and what the implications are for the country, politically and culturally. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If you were 56 years old, struggling to make $12,000 a year and living in a dangerous city, would you feel patriotic? The answer is probably yes. Sociologist Francesco Duino met this man and more than 60 others who would be described by most people as poor, yet they love their country fiercely, even more so than people who earn more money. Why? Francesco Duino is in the studio with me today. He is a professor of sociology at Bates College and is the author of several books, including Winning: Reflections on an American Obsession. The title of his new book is Broke and Patriotic: Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about income, class, and patriotism? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Francesco Duino, welcome. How did you get the idea for this project?
Thank you, Jennifer. The idea came basically from traveling around the country and seeing, in many cases, you know, very humble homes, rundown places, and people who seem to have very little in terms of financial resources, and seeing an amazing display of flags and national symbols that spoke clearly of the fact that they truly love their country. And I thought that was a sort of a potential contradiction or a puzzle, at least in my mind. And so I wanted to discover more, and that was many years ago, and so I sort of did that.
You went to Montana and Alabama. How did you choose those two states? How did you pick the people you wanted to interview?
Well, I chose those two states because they're very different from each other, and also because they are, statistically speaking, basically very patriotic in general, but especially there are high levels of patriotism among the poor. So those would be considered hotbeds of patriotism among poor Americans, and they're also very different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And once there, I basically spent time in laundromats, bus stations, streets, shelters, used clothing stores, and waited for people to come. And often they had a lot of time on their hands. And I approached them and started talking to them, and then eventually asked them if they wanted to be interviewed after an initial screening on my part. And then I conducted about 63 interviews, each an hour long.
Were people wary of you, or were they willing to be interviewed? Did they want to tell their stories?
They were very eager, actually, to talk, and they had a lot of things to say. They were very open in most cases and very willing to explain to me why they love their country so much, our country so much.
Interesting. I think a big part of this book is a definition of patriotism, because it's one of those words we all think we know what it means, but it probably means something different to everybody. How did you define it in terms of your research for this project?
Now, that's a very good question. And I have a particular definition that I used also for screening people. And the definition was not only a love of country, but a sense that, you know, America is better than most other countries on earth, or is superior, or is the place, the best place on earth in one way or another, a certain sense of superiority on the part of the United States.
And have you had pushback on this definition of patriotism?
Not really. What I've had pushback on is my findings, and the logic behind what people said, or even pushback about the mindset of the people that I spoke with. Many have been very suspicious of the respondents themselves and sometimes discrediting what they have to say.
When you met these more than 60 people and talked to them so in depth, did you were you surprised at all by what you found?
Yes and no. I knew that they were going to be very patriotic because the data suggests that upwards of 90% of, in general, 87% of Americans, and for poor Americans, 90% are very patriotic. So I wasn't surprised by that. What I was surprised by was their logic and the sophistication of their reasoning, the richness of their reasoning, and as well their intensity of their emotions. Many times I had people cry as they were explaining to me their life stories and how their love of the country fit into their life stories. And for the most part, these were very poor Americans. Actually, all of them were. And for the most part, many had a very difficult life, in trajectory-wise, in jail, prostitution, drug dealings, addictions of all kinds. And so there was an emotional component to it.
So despite people who had been in jail, people who'd struggled with addiction, these people still love this country. We're speaking with Bates College professor, sociologist Francesco Duina. His new book is Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. What are your findings? Why are poor Americans so patriotic?
Well, I found three basic answers. The first was that they perceive of the United States as still the land of milk and honey, a very, very rich place, a very generous place in the world where everyone wants to still come, and also a place that you can where you can always make it. And in this regard, they took responsibility themselves for their failures. And that maybe we can talk about that a little bit later as to how they were able to differentiate and take ownership of their trajectory. The second finding was the most common was they associated America with freedom, both mental and physical freedom, thinking what you want to think, believing what you want to believe, being homeless if one chooses to. I heard that a lot, and not being pushed in certain directions. And the third was a sort of a transcendental belief that America is the last hope for humankind, that it represents still this, bright city on a hill. And also tied with that, amazingly, and I didn't expect this, a sense that America and God are intertwined and that God loves America only so far and only for as long as America loves God back. But some people felt we don't do such a good job, but a sense that, America is God's chosen nation. And therefore, why wouldn't you want to live here if this is God's country?
Interesting. I want to get back to something you said before, that people feel responsible for their own trajectory. We've all seen the data that show that the United States really has lower social mobility than other developed countries, that the reality is, at least if you look at this, the statistics, you have less of a chance of rising from poverty into the middle class in our country than in especially Western Europe. Do the people you interviewed not feel this?
They didn't. And in some cases, I pushed back on this very fact. I would kind of confront them a little bit at the end and say, but look at all this data about increasing inequality in the United States, far higher than inequality in any other country on earth, advanced country on earth. Wages, they're stagnant. They work in average far more hours than the poor elsewhere. There is less intergenerational mobility. Yes, all of these things. And nonetheless, they had a tendency to disassociate personal trajectories from their love of country. They also had a tendency to split the nation from the government or from the state, as we would say in sociology. So, they had many things critical to say about the government and the state especially in Montana, as you can probably imagine, for various libertarian reasons, and in the South for various racial historical reasons. But they were very, very protective of the nation, of the social contract. And so they were able to say the social contract is still there. We may go astray from it, but it's there, and it's a superior kind of social contract. It's a unique, in historical terms, social contract. And so we hang on to it.
Was there a hopefulness that things will improve in this country?
That's right. So there was definitely a hopefulness that their own fortunes actually would improve. Many of them would tell me, you know, on Monday I have a job lined up and things are going to turn around. Or on Thursday I found God and so I'm on a different path. Or I found God 3 years ago. I'm still struggling. But, I'm about to just set myself right. And so there was absolutely a high level of optimism. Also, I should say, data clearly indicates that Americans believe in personal responsibility, much more so than both for success and failure. They sort of say, well, it was not God's fault or merit. It's not my family's fault or merit. I am what I am because of the choices I make. And so they, you know, that was a very clear stance on their part.
You know, it's interesting to me that you interviewed such a variety of people. You interviewed people of different racial backgrounds, different, some had served in the military, some had not, but also people who are liberal and conservative. Someone may, not having read your book or not having read some of the articles you've written, Francesco, believe that, you know, the poor Americans who are patriotic are the Trump voters. But you found it's much larger than that, right?
Absolutely. If you have 90% of the of a particular segment of the population saying that they're very patriotic, it's going to cover just about everybody, no matter how you cut it, by gender, by religion, by whatever, political inclinations. I purposely selected a variety of respondents. So I purposely spoke to liberal, conservative, veterans, non-veterans, men, women, black, white, Latinos, Native Americans, a variety of people. The narrative varied a little bit across the segments. I expected that, particularly, I would say, between African Americans in the South and maybe sort of white Americans in Montana. But by and large, very liberal, and liberal Americans are very patriotic. In fact, some statistics suggest that they're more patriotic than conservative Americans.
Mm. Getting back to the election, how do you think some of the things you discovered during this research project played out during the last election?
That's a very timely question, of course, and good question. I started this project before the elections, planning for it, and I kind of lucked out in a sense with this project in terms of timing because certainly if you think about Donald Trump's slogan, you know, make America great again, that is a patriotic slogan that has an essence of greatness, if not superiority, towards other countries. So absolutely both Trump and I would say Sanders tapped into a certain amount of patriotism, either existing and a certain maybe disillusionment, again, with the direction of the state, because some of them felt that the state has sort of denied the nation, right? And we need to take the nation back. And that's the rhetoric that Trump definitely used. And it was very, very successful rhetoric.
It's interesting to me because your last book was about America's obsession with winning. Mm-hmm. So it seems as though you've written two books that could make you an advisor to Donald Trump to understanding something that maybe the rest of us don't understand as well as you do.
Well, maybe. I don't know. You know, I mean, Obama also spoke very much about making America number one again. Mm. When all those survey data and statistics came out suggesting that America had lost its number one stand in terms of education and various other things, and he would always say, we need to be winning again. So it's not new. Trump's rhetoric is not new. It just gets repackaged over generations, right? And he was able to put it together in a way, assemble it, if you will. The ingredients are almost always the same. It's just you make different dishes with it. And he made the perfect dish for himself this time around.
Interesting way of thinking about it. I'm wondering now, a few years out from actually interviewing these people, if if some of them stay with you and who you think about again and again, if you want to share a couple of the stories.
Sure. And in fact, a couple of them I am sort of in touch with. They were curious to know where this project would go. I mean, you know, I met people who were one person, can't really reveal his name, who spoke to me. He had a very, very difficult childhood. He was from Alabama, had been an addict of various drugs, had no teeth left at the age of 25. His father used to beat him up, and at the age of 13, he just left home. He just took off and had a very, very tough life, worked very, very hard, and was on disability. And one of the things that he sort of was enlightening for me about was the discussion about guns, which figures prominently in The Love of America as well, and that how guns are important for him and for people in general, at least of this socioeconomic level, for a reason that I had not anticipated, and that is hunting. And hunting means feeding yourself. And therefore, this connection that he made pretty forcefully for me with me about I can own my guns in this country, and therefore I can go hunting. And hunting is key to my survival. And America guarantees that. The sort of logic loop was very revealing, and it was the first time that I heard it.
So maybe somebody who doesn't even hunt, but the possibility that he could hunt if he needed to was important.
That is correct, although he did hunt, and many of the people that I spoke with did hunt, and one of them even gave me a fantastic elk sausage, an enormous one, and he had in his freezer. But absolutely, it was very, very important, and also traditions of generations of hunting. Now, guns, I should say, and that's something that this person and many others spoke about, guns also have, for many of the respondents, have much to do with the genesis of the country and the American Revolution. And in fact, a sense that it was earned via guns, with guns. The British sort of, you know, took away our guns. We made our own guns, and we won independence and freedom that way. So a very visceral attachment to guns. And that was something that also stayed with me. You know, many other people are memorable for their honesty. They were very frank with me, very tender. Of course, many of them had, when I pushed them a little bit, a lack of clarity about many other countries. And I would ask them all sorts of questions. And, you know, I would hear things like, well, Japan is a communist country, or we are in Afghanistan because if we weren't there, the Russians would be in Texas or something like that. Or there are only two democracies in the world, in Israel and the United States. Everybody else is a dictatorship. Or, you know, if I commit a crime in the States, I get 2 months for something. In Germany, I hear they cut your tongue off. And these sort of misconceptions about freedoms in other places was very prevalent. But I think those were more side stories. They weren't at the core of why they really felt. And, you know, at the end of the day, many of them in the most emotional moments would say to me, you know, if you take my love of country away from me, my country away from me, I would have nothing left. This gives us a thread of dignity. Being American gives us a thread of dignity, because I would have a question for them often. If let me take your citizenship away from you, I'll give you Mexican citizenship. How would you feel about that? And they became very, very upset very quickly. And I would say, why do you care? They would say, this is the thing that I can still hang on to. While everything else has gone bad for me, this is the one thing that gives me hope. If you take it away from me, I have nothing left. So lights out on country, lights out on me. That's one lady told me in Alabama.
Mm. So interesting. We're speaking with Francesco Duina. He's a professor of sociology at Bates College. His new book, Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Plummer Senior Living, an apartment community for active Mainers 55 and up on the campus of Ocean View at Falmouth. More at plummerseniorliving.com. And Goggin Energy, committed to moving you into a renewable future with heat pump and solar design. Turn on the power of nature. GogginEnergy.com.
Godless is the new Netflix Western series, built on classic Westerns, but with a twist. It's set in a town run by women because the men died in a mining disaster. It also features a one-armed villain, played by Jeff Daniels, and lots of horses. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer and director Frank Scott. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. From bookstores to banks, restaurants to realtors, Maine Public Radio is supported by a wide variety of businesses and organizations. They understand the importance of Maine Public and our community, and their investment helps make this service possible. More information about business support is available at mainepublic.org. Click on Support, or you can give us a call at 800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. Together we make Maine Public Radio and classical possible.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, why those who seem least likely to achieve the American dream remain fervently patriotic. With me in the studio, Bates College Professor of Sociology, Francesco Duina. We're discussing his new book, Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'll read an email from Emily. I'm going to edit this a little bit, but she says, I'll read it. Your announcement for today's show asks why the poor don't rise up and demand more from their government, describing them as patriotic. I'm used to seeing rising up as very patriotic. Consider the civil rights movement. I grew up with a Pete Seeger album that quoted George Sands, "We must never forget nor try to dissimulate this anger, which is one of the most passionate forms of love in response to the Vietnam War." Perhaps you didn't mean to equate poor people's not complaining with patriotism, but it came across that way to me. Did you talk to people about social issues such as protest? And I'm going to draw into this the debate over the flag right now and the national anthem.
Emily's question is excellent. And, of course, we have many cases of rising up. If one feels there is a violation of the social contract, the civil rights movement was precisely framed as that. The social contract is fine. We just haven't lived up to it. And, of course, American history is full of that with the feminist movement as well and others. The question that I pose in the book is why don't they rise up given their economic inequality? And that is, for better or worse, not part of the American social contract. The American social contract says that everyone has an equal opportunity, but we will tolerate inequality of outcomes in economic terms. And therefore, my question was, you know, they have so little. Why aren't they demanding more in terms of economic opportunities? Because that is the one thing they're lacking, and they just aren't. They're not expecting an answer from the government in that regard.
And one of the people you interviewed was involved in the civil rights movement.
Yes, more than one. And one marched with Martin Luther King and actually looked at me straight in the eye and said, if I wasn't on medication right now, I'd be killing you. I remember that was one interesting moment. But he also said to me that that he loves America. He would stand and serve in the army if there was a need for it, even though he's too old, I suppose, for doing that now at this point. And had absolutely no resentment towards the country. In fact, many African Americans in the South had very little resentment towards the country. And I would push them on this, and I would say, I'm here in Alabama. I'm here in Birmingham, the site of so much suffering. And they would say, well, that was two or three generations ago, or two generations ago, and I stand on my own 2 feet now, and it's my problem if I'm not doing well, which I thought was somewhat shocking, surprising to me, but nonetheless, even they took the personal responsibility narrative or myth, right? It could be a myth in their hands. And that way, you know, maybe if they didn't believe that, they would ask for more, right? But they believe in their own personal responsibility, and that cuts both ways. Many of the findings cut both ways. Many of the findings that I had.
We'll go to Jim calling from Rockport. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Professor, I found your introduction very interesting. I wonder if your observations might speak to somewhat of an impoverishment of our students or our young people's understanding of our civic engagement or seeming lack of our knowledge of our civic rituals, which I think President Reagan mentioned in his farewell address of 1998. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, that's a good question. So, I didn't speak to young people. Some were young. Most of the respondents that I met felt, certainly, that we are not civically engaged enough, that schools should teach patriotic things more. Many of them lamented the fact that the Pledge of Allegiance is no longer a requirement in many schools, although my kids actually recite it every morning here in Maine. And many of them, yes, sort of felt a certain, negative feeling about apathy. On the other hand, I also have to say many of the respondents that I spoke with actually didn't vote. And some didn't even know, some of them didn't even know the difference between Democrats and Republicans. So there was a good degree of disengagement. But as to your question, I guess, I do believe, of course, there's data to suggest that young Americans are more removed from civic participation than. On the other hand, there are different ways of participating now, right? In the old days, you would march. Today, maybe you tweet, and it's very difficult to know. The social movements are so diffused and so fragmented, it's hard to know what counts as participation and what doesn't.
Interesting question. Thank you, Tim.
Yes, thank
We're going to move to Walter calling from Cushing. Hi, Walter. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I have mainly an observation. I grew up in deep working class family in Europe, in Austria. My father went to school for 3 years, lumberjack, five children. So we were really lower working class. I live now in the United States, and I'm an emergency room physician here in Maine. And I see a cross-section of people at my work, and I cannot tell you how often I have had tears in my eyes after seeing patients in the exam room that remind me of my parents. And I see the struggle that the people here have. It's absolutely incredible. The people, my parents, in spite of their poverty, they did not have struggle. They had a very rich, full life. And people here, they have to fight for their life. They cannot afford their medicines. The husband cannot buy his medicines for his hypertension. Their wife has to give up her diabetes medicine so that he has his medicine. It's completely inconceivable to me that these things can happen. And I think the working class here in the United States has no idea how the working class in other industrialized nations live. And that's the only way the status quo can continue here, because otherwise it wouldn't stay like that. That's just a comment and an observation.
Well, thank you, Walter, for sharing that. And I'll just add a little bit to your story or your comment. Absolutely, I agree with you, and that was part of my puzzle, right? Also because I will tell you that in most European countries, poor Europeans, poor Portuguese, Spaniards, Austrians, Germans, actually are less patriotic than poor Americans by a considerable amount, percentage amount, depending on the country. But they're actually far less likely to speak in patriotic terms about their country, even though they're better taken care of. And so that's absolutely correct.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it varies by country. So, for instance, I can't speak on behalf of Austria, though I can maybe guess it, but say for Germany, there is, of course, a tendency, or Japan as well, a tendency to distance yourself from nationalistic tendency narratives because of the war.
World War II, yes.
Yes. But each country is a bit different. In Portugal and Spain, you have the fascism that lasted into the 70s. So there is a story there, right? And so it varies by country. In Denmark and the Scandinavian countries, they're actually quite like their country. They're high levels. Canadians are almost similar to us. The Japanese are a bit less. Of course, same thing probably as with the Germans and Austrians and Italians to some extent. So it varies by country quite a lot. But on average, for sure, there's no question about it. In Americans, the poor in America are much more patriotic than just about in any other country, developed country, and many developing countries, which is a puzzle, per what Walter said.
Walter, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. We're going to go to Mary, who's calling from Wells. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Wait a minute. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. So when you had mentioned earlier that it was perceived that the United States and Israel are the free countries within the world, when you probed further, or did you probe further, and where they gathered that information or formed those opinions?
Oh, that's another fantastic question. I did probe further about that and other misconceptions about, you know, other things. And inevitably, I would run into a position of retreat. So they would say, well, I kind of heard, I thought I knew it, or I heard it, or I read it, or I saw it on TV, or that's what my parents taught us. And when I would say, well, what do you know? Do you know if it's accurate? They would say, well, I don't know, but I do know, you know, that my brother went out to Iraq and died and for our freedom. And I know we are the best country on earth for that. And no one else does what we do. I mean, one fellow told me, you know, I don't know much, but I do know that I watch TV. I see that we're helping a lot of African countries. And you don't see the Chinese doing the same thing. So while, in fact, the Chinese are actually very active in Africa in one way or another, right? And so, you know, they're largely, I think, misconceptions on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there are certain threads that are true, right? Another common theme that I heard was, you know, I may be poor and broke in America, and it goes back to Walter's point as well. I may be broke, poor, and so on, but here I'm worth as much as the president of the United States. I count in principle as much as the president of the United States. And I have to say they're right. And they're more right here saying that than I would say a European in a certain way. In principle. In fact, it's not that way. But in principle, they really, really felt very protective of that sense and that feeling. And so you can push them a little bit, but then it comes down to those kinds of core beliefs. And then there's no more pushing. There's pushing back.
Mary, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Mary.
We're going to go to Beattie calling from Camden. Hi, Beattie. Go ahead.
I think it's probably incorrect what I'm going to guess, because I think it's partly the press that is doing, you know, culturing the beliefs that you're talking about. But I was wondering if you might have picked up a sense of belonging to the place, you know, the rural, I don't know how much you were talking to rural or urban poor people, but I'm assuming rural, and that the sense of belonging in a place with a community where you take care of your own and you don't count on handouts. They talk about that a lot, because that somehow brings you down. And that this sense of place is very strong and helps sustain people in a way that maybe is partly a trap, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Beattie, yes. I mean, that's exactly right. It's a trap and it's true. I did speak among my methods. You know, one of my criteria for speaking to people was rural versus urban. So I was in both rural and urban places. I think that the scenario or language you described about counting on yourself and just the local community, maybe a little bit, and then you're on your own, was especially true in Montana. And in Montana, this sort of libertarian sense that I'm on my own, we are on our own. And in fact, we don't want the government to do anything for us. In a lot of language about we're being watched all the times, police cars everywhere. They don't even say serve and protect anymore on their, you know, they're just everywhere. The phone, everything's tapped. And we don't want that. We just want to be on our own. We want to have our guns and land and take care of ourselves. And if we're allowed to do that, we can survive. So that sentiment was definitely there in Montana especially. But in general, I felt that there was a sense of ownership of the country, no matter with whom I was speaking, right? That the country belongs to them, rather than they belong to the country. And that's another difference between, say, the United States and, say, other European or other countries in the world. It's a sense of ownership.
Well, I was wondering, too, when you were talking about the sense of patriotism being lower in Europe, and then Beattie bringing up the point that somehow some people feel like a handout brings them down.
Right.
Is there that sense in other countries that where people are do have more government aid that somehow that aid is bringing them down?
No, I don't know if BD knows this or not, but they're asking for more. They want more. They're dissatisfied with what they get. I only heard satisfaction. In Alabama, I heard a lot of satisfaction and gratitude saying, you know, I bought these glasses for a dollar, the rest the government paid. Or I'm homeless tonight. I'm homeless, but I have a place to sleep, whether it's the Salvation Army or somewhere else. And I'm grateful for everything that I get. And so they weren't asking for more at all. They were very grateful for, even if I would tell them, you know, if you lived in South Korea, you would have more. And they would say, I don't want to live in South Korea. I want to live right here. This is the best country on earth. So it's a circular logic. But, you know, it's make-believe too. And at the end of the day, you know, the reality is what you believe a little bit in. And it's difficult to criticize them. Or one of the things I try to do in the book is not to judge them at all and not to say they are deluded or not deluded. It's simply this is what they are. This is what they believe. And there's a certain beauty to it and a self-fulfilling prophecy to it as well. Tragic and at the same time uplifting.
BD, thank you so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566, and our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. Join me and two former diplomats for a conversation about the work of the State Department and proposed changes to the organization. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. And the law firm of Eaton Peabody's Financial Institutions Group, working to provide effective counsel to meet demands of 21st century banking clients.
The number of overdose-related deaths in the U.S. keeps climbing and climbing.
2008, we had about 36,000 Americans who died of drug overdose. In 2015, it was 52,000. And in 2016, it was 64,000.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein tells us what the Justice Department is doing about it. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, learning to live with coastlines that are on the move.
We should be looking at the immediate shoreline with the understanding that we're going to get to use it for a limited time.
Also, what impact rising seas are having on property values.
Nationwide property prices have been up pretty steadily in the last few years, and coastal properties aren't going up at the same rate.
Uncertainty and living on the coast on the next Climate One.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, why the poor remain so hopeful about the promise of America. In the studio with me, Francesca Duina. He's professor of sociology at Bates College and the author of several books, including Winning, Reflections on an American Obsession. We are discussing his new book, Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Going to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm somewhat confused. You speak over and over about the sophistication of these people. They seem to have little knowledge of the world and little knowledge of how our government works, which doesn't speak to sophistication. In particular, our president is a draft dodger, and he, you know, I'm a 100% disabled vet, so I have served, so I have some ways, you know, some reason to talk about it. I have bone spurs. The reason he was deferred was because of bone spurs.
Mm-hmm.
I've had them removed, and they've come back, and I can have them removed again. But the point is, his daddy could easily have afforded to have those things taken care of, and he chose not to so that he could get out of the draft. I don't find sophistication there. I find ignorance.
So wondering how these people can resonate with Donald Trump, who, in your view, is a draft dodger. Go ahead.
Not my view. It's a fact.
Right. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the In a way, of course, you're correct, Larry, they are not sophisticated, right? On the other hand, I at least was impressed by both their knowledge of American history at a basic level, but a sense of where the country's coming from and the nature of the social contract in a sort of abstract way. I didn't expect to find that at all. Then, having said that, of course, they don't know the details. They don't necessarily keep up with the news, and they believe very often contradictory things. But, you know, they're not supposed to be, I don't know, academics in a certain sense, right? They're allowed to have multiple contradictory feelings. I just appreciated the way they were able to show a deep knowledge of the country and what the country is in principle about.
Larry, thanks for your call. We're going to move on. Let's see. We'll go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Peyton. Hi, Peyton. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Really fascinating discussion. And, you know, ideas like equality of opportunity and equality of condition all swirl around. And I'm always confused, you know, why a lot of folks that would be maybe the poorest would vote against something in their self-interest, you know, like maybe nationalizing health care or universal health care. And why you would have large blocks of those people that would be voting against something that would just make sense just for the condition they're living in. That's always been very confusing.
Mm. Well, there is it is a puzzle. It is a well-known puzzle among political scientists and others. There are books about that, such as What's the Matter with Kansas, that came out a while ago, asking precisely this question, that they seem to be voting against their self-interest. One could say they do. At the same time, I think that when they vote in a certain way, the rhetoric with which they're approached doesn't tell them the whole story, right? It doesn't tell them the whole truth. And I would say that in the case of Trump, for example, many people voted against their self-interest at one level, but voted something that he said resonated with their self-interest at another level. And so I think they kind of, do they get fooled or they just selectively listen to what they want to hear? Especially with regards to the alternative, which may be packaged in a way that doesn't appeal to them. And that's always very important. We saw this in these elections. Hillary Clinton did not come up with a very, I mean, do you remember, does anyone remember what her slogan was? I don't. I remember Trump's. So that says something.
Peyton, thanks for your call.
You.
We have an email from Snav. He writes, I hear people who are poor criticize people who protest as unpatriotic or un-American. How can you explain this? And this is, I think, similar to people who are upset about the Colin Kaepernick and the NFL football players who are taking a knee, a protest being unpatriotic.
And so the question is,
how do you explain this?
How do you explain that people are upset, especially people upset? I think, again, because I don't think, at least I found that all the people that I spoke with, but for three, I should say, the book I have 60 are very patriotic, three are not. And I have a chapter on a section on why they're not. So if you want to hear a counter narrative, it's there. I think that they simply differentiate between their economic situation and the more cognitive, cultural stuff that goes on in their minds. And, you know, being in dire economic situations doesn't necessarily mean that they shouldn't vote. They shouldn't love their country. On the other hand, and that is really the kind of the punchline of what I found, is on the contrary, precisely because they're down, loving their country gives them a sense of really, it all comes down to dignity. And that's really what I found. They find dignity in being Americans. And so everything could be coming down on their heads. It doesn't matter. They're American. And that if you ask them that question, that's how they're going to answer. They're not going to point to America for their economic situation.
Janelle on Facebook says, I'm wondering how religion plays a role in patriotism among poorer communities.
Janelle, that's something that I looked into a great deal, a lot. The answer is a lot. God showed up a lot in all sorts of ways, both at the macro level, if you will, about the country, and at the personal level. Many of these people had made, in their own words, bad choices. And many of them said, I came out of that lifestyle by making a deal with God. I remember the place and spot when God said to me, I can pick you, I can go with you, but you have to pick yourself up, and it's a partnership. And then they will move in that direction. And I think that, and you know, this being God's country, they would refer to the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, the reference to God, even though it was added late into the Pledge of Allegiance, or the, you know, the, our bills, In God We Trust, and all sorts of things like that. They kind of bring it all together. And so God is in my heart, and God is, and we are in God's country, and this is why this is a great country.
An email from Matt. I can't help but recall a recent conversation with a man where a man in the midst of great struggles expressed finding comfort when he felt part of a team, in particular citing, I'd rather be the worst player on a championship team than an all-star on the last place team. I wonder, when your guest speaks about many folks taking responsibility for their circumstance, is this somehow tied to similar thinking?
All right. So, well, I'll push it even further. There is psychological research that suggests that people at the bottom of a group in terms of hierarchy actually have a tendency to hang on to the group and to find it legitimate, because if they do so, they feel like their position is okay. If they find it illegitimate, then they have a reason to feel very dissatisfied with their position. It's an unfair position. So yes, in a certain sense, if you're, you know, at the bottom, you almost want to believe that it's a fair and good outcome and you're part of a good group. You just happen to be at the bottom, right? And this is one of the many ways in which I discuss in this project, in the book, you know, it cuts both ways, right? This, if you think this way, you won't ask for change. And because you feel like it's legitimate.
So this is why dictators throughout history have encouraged great nationalism.
Dictators are populists by and large, and populism is a form of course, patriotism and nationalism. It's an appeal to belonging and saying, if you don't belong, we'll get rid of you because you should belong. And I'm speaking, of course, most dictators speak to the people. They don't speak to the elites. In fact, they come to power against the elites, whoever they perceive to be the elites. But they rebel, there's a rebellion usually, and they say, we're going to think of Chavez in Venezuela, think of Hitler with the Jews and the international elites, you know, punishing Germany and speaking to the people, to the disenfranchised. Absolutely.
We'll go to Nichols, calling from Eastport. Hi, Nichols. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you know, listening to the radio, I've sort of answered my own question. But I have another, which is about health care. And I wonder why this group doesn't seem to believe that other countries do have health care systems, and why they don't really go to their own legislators and insist that we have greater health care.
Mm-hmm. Well, the population I spoke with, some of them were next to Canada, you know, in Montana, and I would bring Canada to their mind, and it would say, you know, in Canada, you would have certain benefits, and they would say, well, I don't know, I've been there once, I didn't really like it, you know. So they don't really consider this alternative. Also, I have to say, I don't know if they were truthful or not, but many of the people I spoke with seem to have access to some basic care. Whether they're because through the you know, the military service venue, or by virtue of having no money, they have some sort of right social programs that take care of their glasses and medications to some extent. So actually, maybe they have more access to care than the folks who make a little bit more money than these people who can't afford insurance but don't have access to Medicaid.
Nichols, thanks for your call. We'll go to another Larry in Caribou. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
You know, I think Martin Luther King expressed it succinctly. In all the world, nothing is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. And that said, Edward L. Bernay, the father of spin, was an American. We're amongst the most heavily propagandized countries in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Patriotism is drilled into us from the time we're born. Mm-hmm. We're told that America is a shining city on the hill, and everybody believes it because it's groupthink. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to change on the spectrum that the professor is talking about, mm-hmm. because they're afraid, mm-hmm. quite literally, to go against the groupthink. Mm-hmm. And they'll accept any kind of nonsense or substitute for you know, what people take for granted all over the world, you know, better health care systems than the United States has. They'll just take that because, oh, I don't like socialism because, it, you know, my party says it's bad. Well, everybody in the military who served honorably gets medical care. It's socialism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're running low on time, so I will give you a chance to respond, Francesco.
What can I say? I agree to a good extent. I think you put it pretty well. I would just add maybe a comment. You know, everybody has to believe in something, right? And I agree with you. That's why I wrote the book. Like, well, all these flags, all these Pledge of Allegiance everywhere, before every sport event. I mean, what is this? This is, you know, indoctrination, right? But everybody has to have a narrative, a sort of way of making, having meaning in their lives. This happens to be the way in which these people who lack a lot make meaning out of their, you know, have meaning or get some meaning out of their lives. Who are we to criticize them in a certain way? We could, you know, or think that they are not intelligent for doing so. I think each of us has myths by which we live and stories we tell ourselves all the time. And if I looked into anyone's brain, I can probably say, well, they're half deluded and they're half lucid. And, you know, so are they. So it's kind of how I perhaps unsatisfactorily put it in the book.
Larry, thanks for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question here quickly. Curious if the people you spoke to believed that President Obama was not patriotic. Did they buy into the stereotypes perpetuated by Trump, et cetera, that he was not an American, not a Christian, et cetera?
That's a fantastic way to, I think, end this session. Yes, many of them did. And in fact, I think, going back to Trump's narrative, I think that, you know, we have different definitions of the nation, right? And for some of these respondents, the nation is made up of white people, and particularly maybe Anglo-Saxon people. Anyone outside of that is sort of an affront. And I think that they would describe the Obama's presidency that way without saying, well, because he's African-American, but because of the policies he chooses, he doesn't live up to the American dream. But it's a veiled criticism of, you know, white America as we knew it is we're losing it. Demographically, we're losing it. We're just being left behind. And so it's a section of the American population that thinks that. And that's why probably they voted for Trump.
All right. Well, thank you so much. What an interesting conversation. Francesco Duina, professor of sociology at Bates College, the author of several books, including Winning, Reflections on an American Obsession. His new book is Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our archives at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about the work of American diplomats and proposed changes to the State Department. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.